Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night. That means a brand new episode of Graphic Policy Radio, the show that mixes comics and politics. This is the show for folks who wonder when Batman will get off his ass and finally catch Mr. Freeze so he can be done with the freezing cold weather. I'm your host, Brett, or as John Travolta would call me, Bruce Spooner. For tonight's episode, for tonight's episode, we have a couple of things on tap. We're discussing the new Tomb Raider comic from Dark Horse, written by Gail Simone. And Archaea's Hacktivist, which is got a big name of Alyssa Milano attached, and recent statements by Image's Eric Stevenson at the Comics Pro meeting about the industry, shops, various properties, somewhat controversial statements, but got a lot of talking, so that's good. As always, I'm joined by Alana, the Travoltized Eleanor Lesowitz.
Nice, thank you.
Yeah, that's the thing that came together at, like, the last minute. I saw the Travoltize, your name, and I'm like, done. We're good with this one.
Yeah, this is good. This is good. He had one job to do. One job. Anyway.
Well, the funny is, so So he said that, not to go totally off topic and have nothing to do with, you know, what we're talking, you know, generally talking about, but he said the name. I was like, oh, he's just got some other artist that's singing this, and it's not Idina Menzel.
And then
she gets on there. I was like, it kind of looks like her. I'm not totally positive, but you know, I'm just gonna kind of go with it. And then afterwards, it was like, yeah, he totally botched it. But yeah, massive fail.
Yeah,
but really entertaining. this episode, we've got some cool things to discuss coming off of last week's kick-ass roundtable. So we're going to go review, talk little comics to kind of catch up, because we haven't done that sort of thing for a while. And we've had some interesting releases. So I guess let's start off with that and do Tomb Raider. So for folks who don't know, Tomb Raider is a video game that has been around for, probably like 20 years at this point. Came out on the original PlayStation many, many, many years ago. It would probably be, about 17, 18 years ago. Stars a character named Lara Croft, one of the very few heroines in video games. She's at this point fairly iconic. She's a female version of Indiana Jones. Had many iterations. Last year, she received a reboot of sorts, kicking off the series again, giving her, de-aging her a bit, making her proportions a bit more realistic, and a very well-received video game that that was very popular. I think it was nominated for a bunch, generally had lots of praise. So Dark Horse picked it up. Dark Horse does a lot of tie-ins, and they've got Gail Simone, who is, we've talked about a bunch, to write the series. And her, I don't know about you, but seeing her name matched up with that property got me very, very interested and intrigued. So what are your thoughts about it? Because I'm fairly torn.
Well, real quick, I mean, all of the things you were saying about Tomb Raider, the video game were true, but there also were a lot of folks who were very concerned about how this framing story that they used where you need to go and, like, rescue Lara Croft in the new video game is really the antithesis of the point of Lara Croft. You know, she saves herself and she's her own hero. And Alyssa Rosenberg wrote some really good stuff about that back when the video game came out, and I do think folks should check it out. Now, I should disclaimer myself wildly, saying I don't really play video games beyond things that were played on Super Nintendo systems. So I never played Tomb Raider. You know, it's IP that I'm familiar with because it's such a huge cultural phenomena, but it's never something I've really paid attention to. But when I saw that Gail Simone was going to be writing Tomb Raider, it was one of those, oh, of course, that's totally who you would hire to write a Tomb Raider comic. And I, you know, was really looking forward to checking it out because I check out anything she does at least once. And I'm, you know, like I said, I'm someone who does not play the video game, although I'm familiar with the concepts and the stories because it's so ubiquitous if you know people who play video games or if you heard of the movies, which are pretty blockbustery. But I totally got it. I understood what was going on, wasn't confused. I was very intrigued. I feel like there's definitely stuff in here that I have a strong suspicion it was completely invented by Gale and is not part of the existing mythos, but maybe I'm wrong. And I thought it was a good comic. When I first read it, I liked it, and then I kind of forgot about it. I didn't think about it for a little while, and I just re-looked at it again right before doing the show, and it reminded me, like, oh, yeah, no, this was pretty intriguing. It's the kind of setup where you really don't know what's going to happen. There's more questions than answers, but you have enough to work from to know that the writer knows where they're going, that there is a direction. This is part of something that there's beginning. It's an interesting mystery. It almost feels, I mean, it's not like it's a detective story, but it is, but the opening comic is a mystery. You don't know why people who were part of this mission she was on are freaking out, and is it supernatural? You know, how is it connecting to her own dreams? And there's interesting dream logic in the comic. I like it.
Cool. So I guess that's the good thing is, like, you who've never played the games, only vaguely familiar with the world, didn't really have issues.
Not at all.
That's good. That's like the,
and
to
maybe
me,
I'm
that's
wrong
like the main
that
goal.
Some things that I think, maybe some things that I think that Gale invented, she didn't, and are actually in the game, but some of them just seem like really Gale-ish on them, so I'm sure she invented them. I like, you know, the sort of expanding, like, I don't know how much of the support, if any of the supporting cast in the comic, are they in the game at all?
As far as I know, like, I've only played the newest one vaguely, like, just a little bit here and there, so I can't say, I haven't played the entire thing through. As usual, I usually play video games for an hour, and then I get bored, because shiny objects. So, I couldn't tell you, does the comic start off, like, from the end of the game? Like, I have no idea. But, I mean, generally, she got some of the vibe. I think my big thing off of it was, you know, video games are so exciting and do get you so pumped up that the first issue was such a mystery that it was a bit of a letdown for me. I wanted something a little bit more action-packed. Like, you know, kind of like the beginning of because, I mean, to me, Lara Croft is the updated Indiana Jones. I'll say it and compare it as, like, I kind of wanted at the beginning of her stealing the idol and the big boulder chasing her sort of thing.
right,
you know,
right.
Just a bit more adrenaline, I guess, would be the big thing. Like, it wasn't bad. It was just, it was a story. Like, it was just a slower take, a more of a mystery, which is, you know, her prerogative of how she wanted to take it. Like, I don't think it was necessarily bad. It just didn't, for me, it didn't blow me away.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like maybe I'm in the mood for a mystery. Maybe I've been watching too much True Detective or something. But, like, to me, this opening image where you have a flaming man with an escape button on his chest, but not like Human Torch flaming, like flaming in a way that clearly does not seem unhealthy. This seems unhealthy. You know, his head is at an unnatural angle. She's talking to people who she thinks are dead, so this probably is, like, what they look like when they died. Oh, you know, there's just, like, I don't know. It's this sort of dark mystery vibe that, for me, was more interesting than I think it would be if they had been more, like, here's this exciting opening action sequence. So maybe that's just because, like, I can't imagine what that sequence would be. I'm not someone who's the kind of action sequence that you would start an Indiana Jones movie with, I don't always think that really translates so great into a comic form anyway. I guess it depends on the quality of the art.
And I'm kind of with you on that. I think that's the thing where I had issues with it as a whole, and it wasn't necessarily Gale's writing, is so used to Tomb Raider, Indiana Jones, and another video game series, Uncharted, which would be in that kind of genre, as being so cinematic that in my mind, that's kind of what I was expecting, and not getting it, I think, threw me for a loop. And it's not, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing at all. Like, it's good to change stuff up. I think it just threw me off for whatever reason. But yeah, I mean, it's at least, I think it's one where, for me, I will be more into it on the second and third issue than the first issue. that I'm gonna slowly get into it. And there's been a lot of series lately that have been like that, where I thought the first issue was eh, and then slowly I got into it. Like as the whole mystery plays out, it'll be cool. Like it, it's one of those. It was just something was off for me. Who knows? I think it'd be fascinating to find someone that was really into the video game and see what they thought of the comic, because that's the perspective I don't know, and I would be fascinated to see.
Yeah, I'll have to bother a couple of my main video game mainlining friends, see what they think about it. You know, in terms of the art, it's like very neutral in the sense that it's like the people look like real people. Actually, I should give them props for doing a successful job of the women not all looking the same. I mean, there's only two really in this so far, but they don't look the same as each other. Yay. You know, it's like it has a sort of a clean, easy to read, definitely like sort of art that I think would be very legible to people who aren't necessarily super literate in comics. It's definitely not like the art, you know, it doesn't have like, there's no Escher girls. There's none of that crazy, you know, broke back posing or anything.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing I would say I really did like was the mystery itself, in that it starts off with these characters fairly traumatized by their latest adventure. And as much as I love Indiana Jones and Uncharted and all that, that something I always thought was kind of left out in the fact that these folks go through pretty terrorizing events and walk away with like no emotional damage whatsoever. You know, let's face it, like Indiana Jones had spirits from an ark flying around his head, melting people. And he like walked away as if there was like, this was just another day at the job. Which is kind of badass, but at the same time, I was like, really, you're not going to be having terrors for months on end dealing with what you just saw? So it starting off with that, I think, was cool, and it did show the character wasn't just a treasure-hunting, globe-trotting, you know, ass-kicking person, but she also had some depth, and there was a bit of emotional... there was depth to her. Like, you know, that these things actually do impact her, which isn't something you normally see. And I will give definite props on that. I enjoyed it.
I'm really geeking off now thinking about, like, the parallels between Tomb Raider and True Detective, which is a sentence I never thought I'd say. And I didn't watch any True Detective until after I read Tomb Raider. So that might also have something to do with the fact that I didn't really realize this until I said it out loud. But I'm going to stew on this. I tweeted it at Gail. I'm curious if she has any thoughts about that as well.
I haven't yet watched it. I'm waiting for it to wrap up. Yeah, I'm a Walking Dead person, so to me to get sucked into that series at the same time is just possible. So I will be binging on it at some point and finally figuring out what everyone's praising. Yeah.
It's only 8 episodes. Just do it when you're like feeling really emotionally secure and not... susceptible to really, really depressing, traumatizing stuff. But anyway, I just think that's not something I expected to say. I think it's an interesting coincidence and we're sort of both coming out around now, and I'm hoping I can find someone else who's seen the show and has read this comic to talk about that parallel, because maybe it's all in my head, but I feel like there's something in there. And in terms of this mystery that has these weird visual signs in it, and these really, like, traumatized people and, you know, how much of the mystery is in them and how much of it is in the external story. I don't know. I think that's something connected in them.
Okay, now this
and
is...
And bizarre physical phenomena as well.
Yeah, now I have to watch True Detective because this is...
Oh, yeah, you have to watch True Detective. Okay, you just... Yeah.
Yes.
I was thinking that the main thing Tomb Raider has that True Detective doesn't is an awesome female protagonist. So...
Fair enough.
And I'm looking forward to issue two. I'm looking forward to, I don't know when that'll be out, but I'll be definitely taking a look at that.
Yeah, it's one like, you know, the first issue was, I think, good enough and intriguing enough that I want to check more out. So that's good. Like, you know, it, you know, that's about what you can ask for, is that the source material is held up pretty well and, you know, entertaining enough that you want to come back. So, but it was good for you, like, to hear from you that, you know, you who doesn't know Tomb Raider a ton was able to get into it and be like, all right, this makes sense.
Yeah.
This is a good thing. Because I always worry about that. Like, you're going to go and, you know, if you read, like, Mass Effect or Halo and you looked at it and be like, I've got no idea what's going on. Like, that's not a good thing.
Oh, I'm sure. For those, I would have no idea, yeah. I mean, but also the concept of Tomb Raider is not a super hard one to grasp. Like, you can look at her. Like, I think if you watch a TV ad, you're like, I get it, female Indiana Jones. I think that... But I do think that enough people recognize that, even if you haven't, you know, played the game, you have enough cultural exposure to this concept of a character that it won't be confusing at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I out of everything, I think it's a pretty simple one to handle. Like, it's not exactly the most complicated of series or characters. But yeah. So I think we're both agreed, you know, it was good, didn't necessarily, like, really blow either of us away, but worth checking out.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Definitely. Do we move on to the next one? Because this one, I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say.
Yeah.
Because we talked about it briefly when it was announced way back when. So Hacktivist. So Hacktivist, the series, for folks who don't know, is out by Arkea, which is an imprint of Boom Studios. The main creator is Alyssa Milano, and her idea behind the series is what happened, you know, what would happen if one of the really known tech folks out there, I think she uses, like, Sergey Brin all the time in her examples, was actually anonymous. Like, anonymous was just one person and doing it all, and they really were also this tech giant, like a Mark Zuckerberg sort of character. It's in the second issue. I think I've described it pretty well. So I definitely want to hear what you have to say, because it was an interesting discussion way back when this was announced.
Yeah, I actually didn't get the second issue,
okay.
So I should apologize for that. I only saw the first, but
no, first is perfect.
Okay. I mean, to me, asking the question, what if Anonymous was two rich, powerful white men, completely misses the point of Anonymous. Like, it just completely misses the point. It's like, I don't know, it would be like singing the national anthem in German. Like that's not that's not what we're talking about. That's not what this is about at all. You know, I think that there could be an interesting story to tell that has to do with, you know, the secret superheroic acts of some rich white businessman, but I don't find that particularly interesting because we have Batman already. And I don't understand why this is a question that she wants to ask and wants to look into. I mean, maybe there's something down the road that will make it not ridiculous, but to me, like, the point of Anonymous is you're looking at this collective of people from around the world who could be anyone. Like, that's the part of the name, the point of the name, and it's, you know, all different kinds of people who are doing this, and they're acting together and having an impact. So the principle of this piece is just the opposite of it. So I don't get the point.
Yeah, and that's fair. When we first discussed it back, I think it was San Diego Comic-Con, somewhere around there, you mentioned it and said that you thought it kind of defeated the whole point of Anonymous and was kind of, not to put words in your mouth, but was generally pissing over the idea of it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm somewhat with you with it. Like, parts of it I really, really like. And the second issue, gets into more fantasy, more of the things that I enjoy about it. But I'm kind of with you in the same things that I disturbed about it, in that you're basically taking Anonymous, which really is anyone, like, you know, a blank face, it can be anyone, and you're putting two white wealthy men as the face of it,
Captain,
which has
industry.
Yeah, which is connotation unto itself, of, you know, the white savior.
Yeah,
it's the idea of the same issues of, like, having Brad Pitt save the world in World War Z, when the book had an international cast, like, same freaking issues. The things I did like about it was I did dig the dynamic between the two main characters and the obsessive nature of one going through patterns and all that stuff, like knowing a lot of tech folks and, you know, I don't know about your experience, I know those two types of characters. So that was kind of, you know, put a smile on my face a bit, and I did enjoy that. It'd be interesting to get your take on the second issue, because the second issue, the first one's been out for a while, so the first issue ends with basically the CIA and the U.S. government making these guys an offer of, you help us do some stuff in Tunisia, or you're possibly going to jail. And that's how the first issue ends. So the second issue is them dealing with that and what their decisions are. And that unto itself gets a bit fascinating in some of the stuff, because there you get into discussion of the U.S. government using legitimate movements for its own international foreign policy, which I think gets into a very interesting discussion. And
about things that are happening right now in the real world.
Yeah, so, you know, an example is, you know, what's going on with Ukraine, which is a fairly real, or even what was going on in Syria or Egypt or Libya or any of those, where a lot of it was an actual organic people uprising. And then, I don't know if you've seen with Ukraine, is that there was some questions of, like, one of the leaders is on the payroll or was getting money from USAID. So now you get into the question of, was this really organic, or was this guy actually just a puppet of the U.S. government? You know,
those are all interesting things to talk about.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. And the second issue kind of gets into that a little. It doesn't do it justice. And I think my enjoyment of it is more in the fact that it's got me thinking about that, not necessarily the series itself delves into it enough. So I think it does a lot, and there's a lot of cool things. It's just not necessarily as deep as I want. It's fairly shallow.
Yeah. Like I said, it doesn't surprise me too much, but I mean, it's cool to have, you know, different kinds of people making comics and et cetera, but I can't get past, like, the entire concept of what if Zuckerberg and Chris Hughes, like, what if they are anonymous? Like, anonymous isn't even, like, an anonymous person. It's people. It's countless people. That's like, the point. I mean, saying it's actually too incredibly rich, powerful people to start with is just completely disempowering and ridiculous.
Well, so there was something that I wish... And I don't want to give away the second issue because I really want you to read it and come up with your own thoughts off of it. But there's things that I think that could have been done, even in the first issue or the second issue, that could have been fascinating, because, like, there's the whole dark internet that came out of all that, where the State Department was actually looking into technology of doing what these guys were doing in the series. Like, there's this revolution in Tunisia. They kind of locked down the internet. These guys helped block a lot of that stuff for certain people. And the State Department actually was putting together basically packages to do that, where they could drop into areas, which is a fascinating thing to discuss, in that you've got a U.S. government providing technology, so thus backing the revolution. So is it really a pure revolution or an organic, or is it a revolution that is part of the U.S.'s foreign policy and thus, you know, Pax Americana? And that's where I wish the series would go. I honestly think, and it's not a shock at Alyssa Milano, she does a lot of international work and she does some great stuff.
Yeah.
I think these are issues I would have rather have seen a Politico take on, someone who really knows their shit. And the series, like, I think it would have been very similar, but would have actually asked a hell of a lot of questions.
Yeah.
A lot of potential. Like, that's what's been killing me. Like, so much potential.
Yeah, no, I think that what you just described in the end, like, that could be an interesting comic. But what exists right now is not that. It's just that. Weird. And so maybe she had this other idea for a comic that was about Pax Americana and then tried to work in Anonymous into it. I don't know. I'll take a look at issue 2, but I'm not. But that's only because I'm getting a free copy of it.
Well, so the other thing that makes me wonder is, because you and I, just in the jobs that we do, you know, how much of our views is tainted by that? Because, you know, I remember when the whole Arab Spring was going on, and we had friends who were helping out doing open internet stuff and making sure these folks had access. So it's one of those where I think you and I almost are, like, too close to the subject. That there's no way in hell we could give a fair interview or a fair review.
That's a good point. But that's also because we're right. We're close to it, and we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept. I'm not totally told on how it's being portrayed.
So, what response I'm seeing actually from what I would quote about that on Twitter seems to be people agreeing with me. So, but you know, whatever. These are the people who I know. So,
good. So we're not that far off. So that makes me feel much better.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. But it's interesting that you and I, you so far on the show, you and I have talked about one comic that is, you know, definitely new intellectual property created by a writer that's with her own thing she came up with, and another that's an interpretation of a popular video game and movie series. I think that's an excellent setup for our next topic.
Yes, it is. So this past week was Comics Pro, which is a gathering of comic retailers, professionals every year, and it usually has a lot of presentations by the various publishers about what's coming up. And at this year's was a speech to retailers from Eric Stevenson, who's the publisher of Image Comics. His speech was interesting, so he talked a lot about the comic industry, its growth, and that having very good material is a good thing, that publishers, or not publishers, stores need to be grassroots organized, or something that we're going to talk about a lot on the show. And the negative is that he kind of crapped on superhero comics, various pricing models, and licensed comics like Transformers, G.I. Joe, My Little Pony. There is retort by Mike Richardson, who is the publisher of Dark Horse, and Ted Adams, the publisher of IDW. They responded, cool. Eric Richardson basically said, he disagrees, he disagrees with Eric Stevenson in that he wants comics in as many places as possible. Stevenson mostly focused on comic shops. Richardson said he works in big box stores, Walmart, Target, anywhere, because that, you know, sales is sales, growth is growth, it's good to get comics on hand. They both have disagreed that Transformers, G.I. Joe, all that stuff gets people to check out comics who might not. IDW has been doing a great job advertising outside of the comic industry. They're distributing comics that are sold to Target, putting comics in Transformers toys. They've really been trying to expand the market. I think I've kind of summed it up.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Well, you know, if you combine the things that all three publishers are saying, you leave me with a much better feeling, like a more positive outlook on the future of comics, actually, because there are so many different things that these three publishers are saying that are right and that are good ideas. I mean, it really shows you that that's the tier of publisher where the big progress and big creative thinking is coming from at this point. I really loved that Image, you know, becoming, began by talking, not began, but like talked so much about the importance of women women's stories, women creators, and like the diversity of content available for the diversity of audience members. I just would underscore that a million times over, you know, when I'm talking about like, here's what the women readership that we've grown are reading primarily, like actually reporting that, and showing that, you know, women are the future and also the present of comics, was really fantastic. I definitely believe that, you know, asking store owners, if people don't feel comfortable in your store, you should find out why. It's like, yes, you have to. Now, that's a hard thing to do, and for them to figure out how to ask those people to get those questions could be challenging, but there's totally ways you can do that. Like, ask you know, people who go to your store, like, hey, does your spouse doesn't come with you, ask her or him, you know, what, if they feel uncomfortable or what the thing, you know what I mean? Have you ever brought a friend here and did that friend leave, and what did that friend think, what did that friend say? You know, one of the great points that I think he was a blogger on Bleeding Cool made in response to all of that stuff was, if you're just walking by the street and you look on a comic store, you just see Superman and Spider-Man already, and you know whether or not you like Superman or Spider-Man, so you think. You've made a decision, and if you, Spider-Man and Superman don't speak to you, you're not going to even go in the comic store, which is why he proposes, and I think it's a great idea, to have bigger, flashier displays of the comics that are not just the main superhero titles. You know, I think if you put up a big display with one of the covers of Pretty Deadly, you would get a very different crew of people in there curious about it. It's so stunning and different looking, and it's like a goth western and surrealist. You know, it's unlike anything else that you'd see in the store. Put that display out there. Show people Pretty Deadly. Put a big display out featuring Saga, since everybody and their mom likes Saga. You know, what that should be the image that people see when they walk by the store. There, people already know that Spider-Man and Batman are there, and they know whether or not they want to see Spider-Man or Batman. You know, even when I try to convince people, whenever I talk to somebody who doesn't read comics, I'm never able to get them started reading a superhero title. Like, it just doesn't happen. I always get them started reading something like Sandman or Saga. That's always the way it works, because people who don't read comics have already decided what they think about superheroes. That is correct. You know, talking about the diversity of content put out by the publisher. One of the points he made also that was really valid was reminding people that Walking Dead was a hugely popular comic book for years before it was a TV show, to the point that the TV show's launch was an event because so many people knew the comic. So the comic for that came first, and that comic had to, you know, be given space to grow and to continue before it was able to become TV property. And I hadn't really thought about that for a long time. But I also think one of the points he made, which is that no matter what you see at Target or another store, they're never going to have as big a display or archives as a comic book specialty store is. And that's one of the reasons why the comic book specialty stores are so important. I mean, of course, at a conference for comic book retailers, the main speaker is going to suck up to comic book retailers. Like, I don't blame him for saying that he doesn't want people to buy comics at Walmart. I don't want people buying comics at Walmart either, because I don't want their Walmart. Walmart is bad. I do think it's good that people buy comics at the toy store or other places, you know, but because that's more avenues that we have into an audience. But that said, yeah, like the heart of the comics community being comic book stores, you know, I think that's an interesting concept to put there, and of course he's going to say that to that audience, and I don't blame him for saying that to that audience. But I do agree that what IDW has done with putting comics, packaging them with toys, is not just brilliant but obvious. I mean, everyone should be freaking doing that. And I don't think it's necessary to... Image is right that we need to create new IP in comics and not just use brands and like concepts that already exist and come up with. I agree with that, but I also think it's perfectly fine to also have titles that are continuations of beloved pre-existing universes and worlds. You know, it's not a either or, it's a yes and kind of a situation. I do think, to be honest, like for example, I think the only IP, you know, like the comic I read that's based on something that isn't based on the comic itself is Adventure Time, and
Yeah, I guess it's hard. I mean, I love the Adventure Time comics, but it is sort of something that I got into because I wanted more Adventure Time. Not just because I saw this comic and thought the comic was cool. But that's not to say that, you know, Adventure Time comics, one, they have a great amount of artistic merit. They're doing some of the most creative stuff right now in terms of art and bringing in really creative artists. And having great diverse representation of comics writers and artists, you know, they're really leading the way out there. So there's room for real innovation and leadership coming from those comics that are based on pre-existing properties, too.
Amen.
Yeah. I was going to say, you're going to sing amen now, aren't you, right? I do also think, it seems like Dark Horse and IDW disagreed with Image's analysis of the problems with the music industry. I can tell you that, I know a lot about the music industry, at least secondhand, because my brother works in it, and the publisher of Image, his analysis is pretty dead on. Like, that is accurate. Like, you know, you could only release so many long-lost Hendrix albums, you know. You have to come up with new artists and develop new talent. I hope that metaphor makes sense out of context of actually reading the article. But people should all really actually go and read the article. I highly recommend that. If you haven't listened to it yet, and you're listening, if you haven't read the articles yet, and you're listening to this in an archive format, just take a few minutes and take a quick look at them. Because both the initial article, that's, you know, the speech that Larson made, and the responses from IDW and Dark Horse, they are both very worthy of your attention. I would have loved to hear more from Dark Horse and IDW, you know, about other things that comic book retailers can do, since that was sort of the initial topic of this. But, you know, I really think that, like, putting the work out of things like Lock and Key, which, you know, is something which IDW does or whatever, and putting that and highlighting that in the stores more so that people walking down the street see that it's not the superheroes in there is great. And I don't think that Image was belittling superheroes at all when they raised the point that people have already made up their mind about whether they like them or not. You know, I'm one of the biggest, I always make fun of myself as being someone who primarily reads capes. Like, that's the vast majority of comics that I read. But it's true. Like, people who like capes are, you know, that audience is only going to be so big. And maybe once someone's, reading top comics about romance, history, science fiction, whatever, maybe they'll find their way into superhero characters too. But the people know whether or not they want to read Spider-Man. You know, they don't need an ad to tell them that. And they do. We do need to have ads online so that people say they like the Spider-Man movie, get advertised Spider-Man comics. The point that Brett has made many times before here still remains. But
yes.
I don't think that Image is using superhero comics. I think that was not an accurate description of what he had said.
I agree with you. What about it?
It's a little bit upsetting. I think both have points. And the right answer is somewhere in between. You have to do a mix of all of what they're saying.
Yeah.
But it's good to hear people saying this. Like, we've talked about this before getting the show started. So the fact that we've got publishers basically championing what we've been saying is a good thing. And the fact that these statistics that we pull on the site from Facebook, which has shown that, you know, women have been a portion of the audience for quite some time, and these folks are finally getting that, acknowledging it. Like, I think this speech justifies everything you and I have said for a year.
Yay!
And it makes me happy. It makes me really kind of happy to see and hear. I mean, to me, the ideal world is you've got your direct market that's got the majority of comics, and then you have things like IDW is doing, where next to the Transformers toys is the Transformer mini comics, next to the TMNT toys is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle mini comics, in the packaging is the comics.
And with the Marvel toys, there's a free code to get a digital comic. And then when you buy your digital comic, there is advertisements for printed comics and where you can find stores if you want to go to stores. And there's actually advertising on Facebook and Google on various websites. When you go to the movies, people hand out comics. When you get a DVD, there's some comics in the packaging that you can watch, read your comics on your TV or put them on your phone or on your computer. All this needs to be done. And there's a holistic thing that there is no one magic bullet. But when you take all that stuff and put it together, that's where you got. And the other good thing on that is a lot of that stuff flows into each other. So you get this nice loop and chain of events where the person sees the movie, is given the comic, is advertised comics on the TV screen, and on the back of the comic they're handed is a website where you can go find shops for they can buy more, and then they go do that, and then you hit them up and you use that data to sell them more stuff, and you go from there. That's the ideal world. And you know what? That's what the corporate world does.
Yeah.
It's amazing that, I think, again, when it comes down to, and I've said it for a while, is that the comic industry is 5 years behind or 10 years behind what every other company is doing, like Amazon or Apple or any other major retailer that's looking to sell things to people. Funnel is the word I was trying to think of.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad to hear people talking about broadening the audience, and recognizing you can't just keep repackaging the same old shit.
Yeah, and that's something I would really praise Image for doing. They do put out a lot of series. They do a lot of stuff that you probably won't find anywhere else. One thing I would take to task that Stevenson said is that he was holding up The Walking Dead and showing that was this series that was thriving before the TV series. It wasn't thriving to the point it is now. It was post-TV series that the trade paperbacks dominate the bestsellers list on Amazon. It wasn't until the TV series that I saw people on the metro on my commute reading the trade paperbacks. So, I think he's selling that a little bit short and a little short-sighted as to chicken and egg as to which came first. I mean, Walking Dead did well, but it's doing amazing now after the TV series, not before. It was not a cultural phenomenon before the TV series. It is a cultural phenomenon post-TV series.
That's a good point, yeah. I mean, you know the series better than me. Do they make any? Does the show make any attempts to get people to read the comics by any chance? Do they let you know if there's a comic book to read? Or
Not really. So it's an interesting thing in that, from what I've been told and heard through the grapevine, is that Robert Kirkman, who's the creator of The Walking Dead, has very little input into that aspect of it, of the series, that AMC really owns it lock, stock, and barrel. This is why you see a different logo on the TV series than you do the comic book. It's very divided. So he might not have the pull to do that. What I have seen, and I will give mad props, is there are some enterprising stores and some various other folks who are using The Walking Dead to advertise. There is a convention here in D.C. in April, and for the last 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, I've seen advertisements for it once or twice during each showing for the convention. So huge props to, and it's awesome, they're using it and using it well to advertise. I know some shops have done some advertising locally, so that's good. I do know for a fact that it was the first season, it might have been the second season, there was a show, Talking Dead, that has guests on afterwards, and Robert Kirkman was on, and he mentioned Comixology, and he basically crashed the site, so many people went to it to buy comics. So that's great to see. But I think they as a whole can do much better making sure that it is apparent these things exist, and more importantly, telling people where you can get them.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much of the audience that watches it has a clue that there's a TV or a comic series that it's based off of.
I need to start asking the people. I don't know who I know who watched the show, but I need to start asking them that. I'm really curious.
Yeah, I think I've done some studies on Facebook, and if I log in now, I could actually probably pull it up, looking at the overlap of the fandom. And if I remember right, there was a lot of the comic that overlaps to the TV series, but a good chunk of the TV series that didn't overlap to the comic. So my guess is there might be a vague awareness. I think a lot of people don't know. I go with the argument, I don't think a lot of people know that comics are a regular thing that you can easily pick up and is a great site for writing business. I've had the discussion with a lot of people where I said, you know, it's great Marvel does all these things and has these movies, but I'm not convinced that people know that after seeing Spider-Man, you can go pick up a Spider-Man comic book. Or even have a clue as to where to go do that.
Well,
I
might not know where to
really
do it, but I'm sure they know Spider-Man comics. They must know Spider-Man comics exist.
Well, to me, I think comics have that nostalgic thing that it was this big thing in the 30s and 40s and maybe the 50s. It was something your parents did. But I don't know if they know that, you know, this is a monthly thing that's constantly going on, that you can go pick up new stuff every single month at these stores. I'm not totally convinced that people are aware of that. I could be wrong.
These are the
questions
people need to start asking each other. I mean, these are the, you know, I'm really encouraged that the publishers are talking about, like, getting out there and talking to more people.
Yeah, I mean, that's the stuff that they should be doing. Like, that's exactly what publishers should be looking up is what's the awareness factor of people who've seen the movies of comic books. And going from there to find that out, I mean, there's things like the I forgot what the grade is for movies opening weekend when they ask you how to rate it, that they actually ask the audiences as they come out, and that's where the cinema score, I think they actually ask people. I think it would be great to ask, you know, through cinema score and be like, are you aware there's comic books, yes or no? And it's a very unscientific, but I think at least gives you an idea as to what's going on.
Yeah. Do you think that the publishers... do you think that there's something to the fact that we need to keep comic book stores themselves as an institution alive?
See, I fall under the thing that I think one of the worst things that ever happened was comics left the spinner racks at 7-Elevens, at local shops and supermarkets. And that I know so many people that said the first comic that they read was getting it off the spinner rack, and I think it's just too hard to find them.
Yeah.
Like, you need that gateway drug, right? Like, you need that easy way to get into it. Spinarax was the way to go. Like, I don't know about you, but I mean, I remember as a kid going to the local, it wasn't even a 7-Eleven, it was like a local pharmacy, and they had Spinarax, and that's where I'd go, and every time I got to, you know, we'd go to the place, I would get a comic or two, and that's where I started reading comics, and that's where I picked up G.I. Joe and Transformers, the comics that Stevenson said weren't all that, you know, aren't real comics. That's what got me into it. And from there, I picked up X-Men and Green Lantern and Superman and kind of expanded from there. But it was Spinarax that sold me. And eventually, when the Spinarax went away, I went to comic shops because that was where you had to go. And that was, you know, that was the 80s.
I think that comic shops definitely intimidate, you know, and make people feel uncomfortable if it's the wrong comic in the wrong environment. Or some people are just really shy, and that's why I think it's great that there's so many different ways and places to get your comics. I think I would be sad if there were no more comic book stores, though, because where else are you going to go and have that sort of be able to talk to someone at the store and get their feedback and and talk with other comics fans. You know, there is a very important community aspect of it. And one of the things that I loved is somebody, they were suggesting doing the comics reading groups book club. I've been wanting to get a comic book club together for ages and have not successfully done that. So I love that suggestion. And that's the kind of thing that could very much both draw people to a comic book store, but also, again, be a reason why it's good to have a comic book store itself.
I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, the comic store should be your community. Like, that is your base organizing area. It's a place where people are knowledgeable. They know what they're talking about. They're the fans. They can give you good suggestions. And it should be opening and welcoming, and there's so many there aren't. I think that's a huge issue. And what Steven said is saying, and, you know, it's talked about a lot of other, it talked about brick and mortars in general, and it went through with the whole digital age, is that the good ones will survive and the horrible ones will go away. Like with record shops, the really good ones stayed around and the crap ones went out of business. And, you know, the music that happened with music stores. And it was painful, and I think you're kind of seeing that with comic shops now. My only fear is that we're in a boom, and I like the 90s. You're having all these people hopping in who don't know what the fuck they're doing, and it's going to artificially inflate things, because the thing that what folks don't, you know, a lot of folks don't take it apart is that the comic book publishers don't sell it to individuals. They sell it to the comic shops. So a comic shop could take a series and buy a million copies, and the publisher would say, oh, we sold a million copies, but if that shop only sells 1,000 copies, it's not true. So I think that X factor that's there is what's the real sell-through at the comic shops, and how healthy really are those comic shops? Because, you know, there could be some inflated numbers here that are making things look better than they really are. And I'm not totally convinced, you know, the shop owners are much more savvy than they were back when I was working in a shop and running a shop, just because of computers and what you're able to do easier now with subscriptions and tracking everything. But I'm still not totally convinced that some of the newer shops or the people that are just getting into it or even some of the longstanding folks some things are artificially inflated, and that's the question that I kind of leave out there that no one really answers.
Artificially inflated by what?
Well, because the shops wind up are the ones that actually purchase. So if you have a shop that's selling comics and isn't really doing tons of tracking and just knows, you know, it's paying its bills, in other words, like when I was running a shop, we had a computer that had the software, or had some software. It was like some spreadsheet software. I totally forgot what it was. And this was early 2000. It was not any really good software out there. And we had some of the comics that we kept on, you know, were getting in. And I generally had a idea of the sell-through. But for me, judging my success was looking on the shelf and vaguely guessing off my gut as to what would sell and what wasn't selling. And as long as I was able to meet my bills, that's what I was judging success by. So I could have had series that I was buying that just sat there and really, when it came down to it, was not worth the investment. But I didn't know that because I wasn't doing that deep of a dive into my purchasing. Like, I know I had game series that I would buy because we did comics, games, and yeah, pretty much comics and games. And some of the games might have sat on the shelf and sat on there for months, but I wouldn't have maybe put two and two together that this entire line or these certain books were dog shit because I wasn't getting debt down into it, really paying attention of how long they were on the shelves, what was my profit margin, how much did that shelf space make for me. You know, as long as I was able to get my shipment from Diamond and get my shipment from, oh, I forgot who the game company was, like, that's what I judged everything by. And this was before technology was really all that fancy, and now folks have better ideas of Squarespace or Square cost of the actual square footage and shelf space and all that stuff. So the smart stores are getting better at that, but I don't know how prevalent that is. So I have this slight fear that people are back to, like, the thought process that I was in, that was still that dark ages, and that they really don't know, you know, they might order big on a series. Like, Stevenson brings up these variants. You know, the variants inflate numbers because people are buying 2-3 copies of stuff, and a first issue comes out, and people are like, oh, this is hot for, like, Image, and I'm going to buy out 3 or 4 copies of it because I'm, you know, being a spectator or speculator, right? You know, is that series really selling the number it was? No, it's selling a decent number, but not nearly what the numbers are actually coming into the stores because you have speculators buying stuff. Success is very difficult, I think, to measure in the comic industry because there is a broken feedback loop overall, and that the publishers really don't necessarily know the sell-through rates at the stores.
Yeah, okay.
I'm trying to kind of give the picture. Like, the perfect example is, like, you know, if you had a series that came out with 3 or 4 different covers and you sold 1,000 copies, but there's people out there buying 3 covers, you didn't really sell it to 1,000 people. You sell it to some number less than 1,000, but all you see is the 1,000, and you're like, sweet, we're doing awesome. I think it kind of makes some folks a little bit more complacent and think they're doing better than they really are.
Gotcha. Complicated stuff.
It is. Like, the industry is really messed up when it comes to all of that.
Well, I mean, heck, it's an industry that demands variants, apparently. Variant covers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
was one thing that was weird. Like, Eric Larson saying that they only put out variants because the buyers ask for them. The whole thing seems like a cyclical bad habit. I'm not sure what your take is, but it's all very silly.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's a bad habit. It's like, we're going to put out, it does really well, and it's that example of, like, holy shit, we sold 10,000 copies because we put out a variant. You didn't really sell 10,000 copies. You sold some number less than 10,000, or you didn't sell it to 10,000 people. You sold it to some number less than 10,000, so your second and third and fourth issues are going to be way less than you think it is, so you're going to be projecting horribly because you don't necessarily know the variance and how that broke out of people purchasing it. So, you know, and then the publishers see that, and they're like, okay, great, we sold 10,000 copies, we're good to go, and the stores are like, great, I sold, you know, whatever number of copies, and I'm going off this, but I don't know how many of are actually looking at, like, I sold 500 copies, but 400 people bought the actual issue, 100 people bought, whatever, 2 copies each. So, really, for my second issue, I need to buy 400 copies because there is no variance, or 350 copies because I'm going to lose this many people, not the 500 copies.
That is crazy.
Comic shops are not easy. Like, it's not a simple thing like a record store where you're like, okay, these albums sell this amount, and this is what we're going to probably go through. Like, it's way more complicated than that. It's a fucked up business. I'll actually put it. It's a fucked up business.
It's up to us to save it, apparently, with our unsolicited advice.
Yeah, it's fun. Like, I wonder how, if I could run a shop now, how I would do with the knowledge that I have and the technology that exists, because I would run it totally different. I would go Moneyball on the shop. Like, that's what the industry needs, is people who are into, like, ridiculously into numbers, running stuff, and really figuring all that out.
Well, I mean, I'm glad that, to get back to our initial topic, I'm glad that the conversation around, you know, Larson's piece has become a really public conversation, and that it's getting talked about beyond just the audience, the store owners. I'm really hoping that, I mean, above anything else, I mean, the DC and Marvel need to pay attention to what Larson said. They need to pay attention to what IDW said. They need to pay attention to what Dark Horse said. They need to do a lot of paying attention.
Yeah, I mean, to me, so, and the other is, I think it's fascinating that, and that Stevenson doesn't mention, is that Marvel and DC have turned into idea factories for larger corporate conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
So their focus isn't necessarily on selling books as much as IDW or Dark Horse or Images. You know, their focus is, we've got the books, but we also have these movies the books are made off of, and toys and T-shirts and bedding and all these other things. And I think their numbers look more at the big picture than necessarily at one individual book sales. And Stevenson seemed to, I think, lightly leave that out in his speech.
Hmm. You know, one of my friends who has completely cut off reading any DC comics whatsoever since the reboot, like, he won't read anything. I don't think he even reads Vertigo. He's, like, not going to read anything. Was saying that he's okay with comics being impenetrable to new people because they just exist as idea factories for making other forms of intellectual property, like movies and TV shows. I was kind of shocked by that. I see what he's saying, but I was still kind of shocked by that.
Yeah, I mean, you need them to be, you need people to get into them. Like, you need both, right? Like, you want an idea factory, so you get the big
movies. He was saying that the comics, that Warner Brothers and Disney should look at comics as a loss leader, as an investment in future stuff, and just not expect to make money off of it. I do think they should look at that
to some extent. They do look at them that way.
Yeah. And I don't think it's wrong for them to try to get more readers, but of course, exactly the ways they try to get more readers is usually the stupidest and most inaccurate way to get more readers. But yay, people talking about women, people talking about comics for kids. People talking about it being more than just superheroes, about there being comics for any kind of topic you could want. Good stuff happening.
To me, the big thing that came out of this, too, is I want to see Stevenson put his money where his mouth is and get some female creators and really push something. Like, it's an independent company. They can really do what the hell they feel like. I want them to go out and recruit some female creators and really push it. They've got a few, but, put the money where the mouth is and actually, like, push that. If you really think that women is where the industry's at and it's a big reason for the surge, then do something to make it bigger.
Yep. Agreed. And that's something we can all agree on.
Yes. So those are all the big topics that we want to discuss. Anything else for the show, or are we going to wrap it up?
No, that's good for me.
All right, cool. So that wraps up another episode of Graphic Policy Radio. I think I was garbled at some point. I'm pretty sure our host, Blog Talk Radio, was a little overwhelmed, judging by some stuff. So I apologize for that. Hopefully I'm clearer now. As always, you can catch us every single day at graphicpolicy.com. You can also catch us on various social networks, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, et cetera, all at Graphic Policy. We keep it nice and consistent. Until next week, I'm Brett.
I'm Ilana.
And keep on reading.